The Tet Offensive of 1968 stunned the world, but no event during those chaotic weeks proved more consequential than the Battle for Hue. This ancient imperial capital, considered safely behind American lines, fell to nearly 10,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong troops in a matter of hours on January 31, 1968. What followed was 24 days of the most intense urban combat Americans had experienced since World War II. The battle transformed America's perception of the Vietnam War, shifting the national conversation from how to win to how to leave. Mark Bowden's masterful account has been hailed by historians as the definitive chronicle of this pivotal moment. Ken Burns called it an extraordinary feat of journalism, while John McCain described it as a magnificent achievement and an indispensable contribution to our understanding of the Vietnam War. The battle's shocking violence and political aftermath would forever change how Americans viewed their government, military leadership, and the war itself. By January 1968, the Vietnam War had settled into a frustrating stalemate. President Johnson and General Westmoreland publicly projected confidence, with Westmoreland famously declaring in late 1967 that the end begins to come into view. Behind the scenes, however, North Vietnamese leaders were planning something audacious, a coordinated nationwide offensive timed to coincide with Tet, Vietnam's Lunar New Year celebration. Hue was the perfect target. As Vietnam's cultural and historical capital, it held immense symbolic importance. The massive citadel fortress with its 26-foot walls enclosed nearly 2 square miles, including the former imperial palace. Unlike most Vietnamese cities, Hue had remained largely untouched by the war. Its population of intellectuals, Buddhists, and Catholics weren't particularly supportive of either side. The military presence was light, fewer than 1,000 ARVN troops and even fewer Americans. What American commanders didn't realize was that for months, young Vietnamese women like Che Thi Mung had been meticulously mapping military positions throughout the city. Posing as innocent hat sellers, Che and her comrades in the elite Huang River Squad tracked guard shifts, weapons placements, and entrances at key facilities, especially the American MACV compound. They flirted with soldiers to extract information, committing everything to memory rather than taking notes. Meanwhile, weapons were being smuggled into the city through ingenious means. Wen Van Quar orchestrated an operation using duck-selling boats with false bottoms and ammunition wrapped in plastic buried deep in egg baskets. Guards were distracted with moonshine and boiled duck delicacies while weapons slipped through checkpoints piece by piece. As January 30th arrived, Hue bustled with Tet preparations. Fishing boats moved on the swollen Huang River while roads teemed with traffic. Vendors sold fresh produce and homemade goods. Pink-blossomed branches decorated homes as families prepared for feasting. Despite rumors of potential attacks, Americans like diplomat Jim Bullington dismissed them as routine concerns. No one imagined the scale of what was coming. The attack began just after 2:30 a.m. on January 31st, during the sacred Tet holiday, when many South Vietnamese troops were on leave. NVA and Viet Cong forces poured into Hue like a mighty python, with over 7,500 fighters streaming across the Perfume River bridges, through the ancient fortress gates, and along the wide Le Loi Avenue before fanning into the narrow side streets of the old imperial city. They arrived in waves, by sampans on rivers and canals, on commandeered motorbikes, and in captured military jeeps. The NVA soldiers wore crisp green uniforms that stood out against the pre-dawn darkness, while Viet Cong fighters blended in wearing civilian khakis or traditional black pajamas. At the MACV compound, Marine Corps advisor Frank Dozema was manning the vulnerable Northwest Guard Tower when he first recognized the distinctive metallic crack of AK-47s echoing through the streets. As he continued returning fire with his M16, an RPG rocket exploded against the tower's roof, the blast nearly severing his right leg. His fellow advisor Jim Koolikin heard the explosion and rushed up the tower's ladder, finding Dozima badly wounded and losing blood rapidly. Unable to safely move him down the narrow ladder, Koolikin improvised, using Dozima's own shower towel as a makeshift tourniquet and administering his last morphine syringe. With no other options and time running out, Koolikin had to complete the amputation using his serrated combat knife before carrying his semi-conscious friend to the compound's medical station. Throughout the MACV compound, American advisors and support personnel found themselves fighting from hastily organized defensive positions, many wearing only underwear, plastic shower sandals, flak vests, and helmets as they grabbed weapons and ammunition. Despite the compound's obvious vulnerability, NVA Lieutenant Colonel Huang's forces didn't press their initial advantage. His assault had been planned assuming two additional support battalions would arrive, but when they failed to materialize, Huang lacked sufficient forces to mount a direct assault on the compound. Instead, his troops methodically occupied the surrounding civilian buildings, setting up sniper positions and machine gun nests to keep the Americans pinned down. By sunrise, the ancient imperial city had fallen in just 3 hours, with only scattered pockets of resistance remaining at the citadel's main gates, around the ARVN's Man Ka headquarters compound, and near the isolated MACV advisory compound. At the ceremonial flag stand in the heart of the citadel, communist forces overcame the guards despite losing one of their own to desperate machine gun fire from the walls. They cut down and ceremonially shredded the yellow and red striped flag of South Vietnam, and at precisely 8 a.m. raised the blue and red striped flag with yellow star of the National Liberation Front. Though initially obscured by the morning fog and mist rising from the Perfume River, this flag would soon be photographed and broadcast around the world, dramatically symbolizing the communist capture of Vietnam's ancient imperial and cultural capital. The fall of Hue marked the beginning of one of the Vietnam War's bloodiest and most pivotal battles. Despite overwhelming evidence that Hue had fallen to a massive enemy force, American leadership remained in denial. General Westmoreland reported to Washington that only approximately 3 companies of enemy troops were in the city, underestimating their actual strength by a factor of 20. This deadly disbelief would cost many American lives. At the American base in Phu Bai, 8 miles south, commanders with no sense of what had happened dispatched 2 companies of Marines, just over 300 men, against 10,000 enemy troops. Captain Batchelor's convoy encountered intense enemy fire as they entered Hue City. Approaching the An Cu Bridge with its satchel charge holes, they raced through what resembled a town in an old Western movie, taking heavy fire from both sides. At a traffic circle surrounded by abandoned ARVN tanks, the Marines dismounted and immediately came under fire from all directions. Batchelor, against his training, rushed to help a wounded man and was hit with 3 rounds in his arm and leg, suffering a broken femur. Tangled in barbed wire, he shouted to Gunnery Sergeant John Canley to take command. The plan to cross the Trung Tien Bridge into the citadel fell apart immediately. The damaged bridge couldn't support tanks, and ARVN tank crews refused to move. Captain Meadows and his men had to cross on foot, exposed to enemy fire. As they reached the bridge's midpoint, the NVA opened fire, killing and wounding many Marines. When they turned onto the gate road, they came under devastating fire from the citadel walls. Meadows quickly realized the mission was hopeless. With over half his company casualties, 7 dead and 45 wounded, he ordered a retreat. During the withdrawal, Meadows personally rescued Private Gerald Kinney, carrying him single-handedly under fire, though Kinney later died. By nightfall, Hue had completely fallen, though American commanders refused to acknowledge the reality. General LaHue and MACV leadership dismissed the Tet Offensive as futile, despite evidence that a large, capable enemy force had seized control of Vietnam's ancient capital. As the Alliance flag flew over the citadel, communist forces consolidated their control of Hue. The front established its field headquarters at Tudom Pagona, an ornate 17th-century tower unlikely to be bombed due to its historical significance. Liberation Radio broadcast appeals throughout the country, calling on people to rise up against the traitorous government, establish revolutionary control, and punish cruel lackeys of the regime. The young commissar set about remaking Hue, condemning Western fashions, confiscating property, and putting citizens to work digging trenches and tunnels. Some families were instructed to create fake weapons from painted bamboo to intimidate American forces. Initially, many residents displayed red flags to show support, but the mood quickly changed as the front's detailed lists of enemies guided systematic purges. These targets went far beyond government officials to include specific individuals like policemen, bus drivers, shop owners, and even restaurant patrons. What began as justice against puppet regime servants quickly spiraled out of control. Writer Tran T. Thu Van documented the civilian horror. Her musician uncle killed by artillery. Families executed for possessing televisions mistaken for communication devices. Vietnamese-American toddlers murdered by VC soldiers who smashed their heads against walls as children of American imperialists. As she observed from across the river, Dong Ba Market has become flat ground, while downtown disappeared under smoke and dust. With each explosion, dust and bricks and tiles fly up as if a gigantic firecracker explodes, throwing corpses up into the air. Many foreigners weren't so fortunate. Steve Miller and Steve Hawkness were arrested. Miller was later found executed, shot in the back of the head. Three German doctors and two French missionaries were killed despite their nationalities. Foreign Service Officer Philip Manhard and several American contractors were paraded through the city and marched to Hanoi, where they remained prisoners until 1973. As official denials continued, journalists risked their lives to document the truth about Hue. Gene Roberts, the new New York Times bureau chief in Vietnam, had arrived just a month earlier. Before his deployment, White House National Security Advisor Walt Rostow had confidently told him the war was effectively won thanks to IR-8 rice, a genetically engineered strain that would transform Vietnam's agriculture and economy. When the Tet Offensive erupted, Roberts sought transportation to Hue and became the first reporter to accurately describe the situation. His New York Times report revealed that Marines controlled only 2 square blocks of the smoking city, while enemy forces maintained a tight grip on Hue. His reporting captured the desperate atmosphere where civilians pressed against buildings and ran across intersections to avoid fire, and where the line between allies and enemies was sometimes just a street width apart. French photojournalist Catherine Leroy took even greater risks. After being captured by France soldiers, a friendly officer had her released, returned her cameras, and invited her to photograph his victorious men in staged combat poses. When she finally reached the MACV compound with Marine escorts, Leroy embraced CBS correspondent John Lawrence, exclaiming, "I love these fucking Marines! They save my life!" Her dramatic photos would soon appear on the cover of Life magazine. Meanwhile, draft-dodging journalist Mike Morrow wandered the Citadel battlefield unarmed, witnessing the war's moral contradictions. Marines ignoring a dying enemy soldier one moment, then risking their lives to save wounded civilians the next. Now smoking 3 packs and drinking a pint of whiskey daily, the cynical former Dartmouth student had concluded the war was immoral and pointless. These journalists' unflinching accounts began shifting American public opinion. Even Walter Cronkite, who had faithfully reported progress in Vietnam, began questioning the official narrative, telling viewers that dispatches from that pathetic country tell a somewhat different story than the Allies' claims of breaking the offensive's back. The night before leaving for Hue, Lieutenant Colonel Ernest Big Ernie Cheatham had a rare opportunity for a combat commander. Time to think. Learning that La Hue had been feeding Marines piecemeal into Hue for 3 days with devastating results made him furious. Colonel Stan Hughes told him bluntly to attack through the city and clean the NVA out with minimal intelligence. Having never fought in a city, Cheatham studied two field manuals, combat in built-up areas, and an assault on a fortified position. The basic strategy was to stay off streets, using walls as both protection and pathways by blasting through them rather than going around. When encountering enemies in buildings, the approach was simple. Flatten, gas, or burn the structure, then send in riflemen to clean up. Cheatham assembled an arsenal of heavy weapons unsuited for jungle warfare, but perfect for urban combat. Korean War-era bazookas, six 106 recoilless rifles mounted on small mule vehicles, gas grenades, gas masks, flamethrowers, and C4 explosives. His convoy to Hugh included these weapons plus two dusters and trucks filled with volunteers from rear positions eager for action. It took Big Ernie Cheatham 4 days to fight his way to the Fukom Canal, long, bloody days with fierce clashes at each municipal building. But once begun, the advance proved unstoppable. Cheatham established a devastating pattern, first bombarding targets with mortars, his sledgehammer, followed by gas plows, then tanks, Antos vehicles, 106s, bazookas, and finally Marines. Cheatham brilliantly used tanks as blockers, sending them alone up front to draw enemy fire and expose positions. The Antos, though more vulnerable, provided devastating firepower. Cheatham would stand beside it, calmly pointing out targets before it fired its six big guns, rocking backward with each blast before speeding to safety. The enemy soon fled at the mere sight of its spotting rifle. For the Marines, urban combat proved brutally different from jungle fighting. Traditional flanking maneuvers meant death in open courtyards. Buildings had to be cleared from bottom up rather than top down as they'd trained. They avoided pre-zero doors and windows, instead blasting entry holes with bazookas, then clearing room by room with grenades and coordinated fire patterns. While Cheatham's forces made progress in southern Hugh, the battle for the citadel proved even more challenging. Major Bob Thompson first glimpsed the fortress on February 11 from across the Huang River. It looked fearsome, designed for defense with its wide moat, narrow bridge approaches, and 11 gates topped by gun towers. The front had occupied most of it for 12 days, establishing a revolutionary government and fortifying positions. Thompson, a tall, fit, serious 37-year-old from Mississippi with no combat command experience, was ordered to enter through the Howe Gate on the north wall. General LaHue dismissively told him the mop-up would take only days and instructed him not to take orders from General Trung, despite Trung's greater experience and knowledge of the citadel. The assault began disastrously. When Thompson's depleted Marine unit tried to cross the river, their first mic boat attempt was turned back by intense fire. Lieutenant Nick War, leading Charlie 1 platoon, felt his testicles retracting from fear as they zigzagged around Hen Island. When they finally landed north of the citadel, one Marine vowed never to get back on them fucking boats, even if he had to swim across the river and walk back to Phu Bai alone. Inside the citadel, the Marines faced a nightmare of urban combat. The city existed in a gloomy palette, from chalky white pulverized plaster to the oily black of dried blood. The constant roar of gunfire and explosions was periodically overshadowed by naval shells from warships anchored miles away in the South China Sea, their projectiles as heavy as small cars whistling overhead before shaking the earth upon impact. The battle's turning point came with the assault on Dong Ba Tower. Captain Myron Harrington was ordered to take the tower with his undermanned Delta Company. Despite being reduced to just two platoons, Harrington led his men along the inside fortress wall. His hopes that the tower might be abandoned were quickly dashed when Lieutenant Conrad and two others were hit by a rocket while scouting from a balcony. At 4 p.m, with Corporal Whitmer's squad in position, Harrington ordered the attack. As the tank provided covering fire, Marines rushed the tower from both sides. By February 21, with La Chu fallen and the southern wall captured, the Battle of Hue was effectively over. General Tolson's reinforced brigade approached from the west, and front troops slipped away through the southwest gates overnight. Life returned to Hugh with astonishing speed. Civilians filled streets, sampans plied the river, and vendors sold food despite occasional gunfire.
The Battle of Hugh's greatest suffering fell upon civilians. The death toll among residents is officially recorded at 5,800, though this is almost certainly an undercount. Many died in bombings, shelling, crossfire, or were buried in collapsed bunkers beneath their homes. Over 80% of the city's structures were destroyed or seriously damaged during the 4 weeks of fighting. Beyond accidental deaths, systematic executions occurred on both sides. The front executed between 300 to 4,856 people, according to competing claims. Douglas Pike, an American Foreign Service officer, studied mass burial sites immediately after the battle and estimated 2,800 executions. The Saigon regime conducted its own reprisals afterward, with no official count recorded. Military casualties included 250 American Marines and soldiers killed, with 1,554 wounded, plus 458 ARVN soldiers killed and about 2,700 wounded. The front lost between 2,400 and 5,000 fighters. The combined death toll exceeded 10,000, making Hugh by far the bloodiest battle of the Vietnam War. The Tet Offensive, and particularly the Battle of Hue, created an unbridgeable credibility gap between military leadership and the American public. The devastating images from Hue, a proud city reduced to ruins, wounded and frightened Marines caught in merciless combat, directly contradicted General Westmoreland's consistently optimistic assessments. The most significant blow came from Walter Cronkite, America's most trusted newsman, who visited Vietnam and concluded in his February 27th broadcast that the war had reached a stalemate. After reviewing the holiday attacks and showing images of Hugh's devastation, Cronkite declared, "We have been too often disappointed by the optimism of American leaders, both in Vietnam and Washington, to have faith any longer in the silver linings they find in the darkest clouds." President Johnson remained stymied by the war, lamenting to Lady Bird, "I can't get out, I can't finish it with what I have got, so what the hell can I do?" Though he abandoned neither the war nor Westmoreland, 1 month after the battle ended, he announced he would not seek re-election. From the perspective of half a century, the Battle of Hue and the entire Vietnam War seem a tragic waste. America's ideological approach ignored regional expertise and understanding. The battle should stand as a caution against war except for vital national interests. The heroism of those who fought remains undeniable, but the exploitation of their idealism by leaders who had lost faith represents a lasting American betrayal. During the first week of fighting inside the Citadel, photographer John Olson captured what would become one of the most famous photographs of the Vietnam War, a patent tank carrying wounded Marines. The striking image showed seven Marines in a tableau worthy of Rembrandt, with dark, muddy colors punctuated by shocking splashes of blood. At the center lay a pale, limp figure shot through the chest, appearing nearly dead. Alvin Burt Grantham was that wounded Marine. While manning his M60 from a house window in Hue, he was struck square in the chest by a rifle round that knocked him backward like being hit by a bus. The bullet shattered his ribs and passed through his lung. After emergency field treatment, he was placed on a wooden door, carried to a tank, and evacuated while drifting in and out of consciousness from excruciating pain. At one aid station, he was mistakenly zipped into a body bag before someone realized he was still alive. While believing he was dying, Grantham's thoughts drifted to childhood memories, a beloved metal tow truck his father gave him during a hospital stay, and Crystal Burgers he'd shared with his friend Freddie after long mornings laying bricks. After multiple complications, including malaria and typhoid fever, Grantham eventually recovered, married, raised a family, and built a successful career. Many veterans struggled with readjustment after Vietnam. Steve Burnson found he couldn't wear his uniform in public as hospital staff warned about anti-war protesters. When asked about his injuries, he initially claimed industrial accident rather than discussing Vietnam. About Hugh, he reflected, "We won the battle, but we lost the war," noting the North Vietnamese successfully held the city for 25 days, capturing world attention. Many Marine officers from the battle achieved remarkable success. Big Ernie Cheatham, Captains Downs and Christmas, Lieutenant Ray Smith, O.K. Steele, and Peter Pace all rose to become generals. Howard Prince retired as an Army Brigadier General and became a professor at the University of Texas. 40 years after the battle, doctors removed an AK-47 round from beneath his kneecap. The Vietnamese veterans interviewed displayed their decorations proudly, viewing Hugh as just one episode in a long heroic struggle against foreign powers. Modern Vietnam is thriving with remarkably little resentment toward Americans, though it remains an authoritarian state where speaking freely about past grievances can be dangerous. Vietnamese veterans view the battle as just one episode in a long struggle against foreign powers, highlighting how differently Vietnamese and Americans perceive this shared history.